Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chods. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
So hello again, Mark. Hello and welcome everybody to the second edition of the Carpcast. Hope you enjoyed the first one. How you doing, Mark?
I'm not doing bad, yourself?
It's been a busy week. In fact, our guest today is Ali Hamidi. We actually recorded him last week, just after the last show. There's quite a bit of talk about the Big Fish Off, which has been all over Facebook, been all over the news, and hopefully you've all managed to see it. We're going to start off with the interview, because the interview happened before the programme was aired. And then after the interview, we're going to go into kind of our thoughts on it, what other people are saying about it. So we'll have the interview at the start of the show this week. I think you're okay with that, Mark?
Yeah, no worries. It's a good interview. He does come across really well, full of enthusiasm, definitely.
Yeah, I've known Ali a lot of years, so he's a great guy. We'll get onto that in just a minute. What have you been up to then? Anything over since we last recorded?
I've had a couple of day sessions and I'm nothing if not consistent, catching like, nothing all the way through, like a proper nod.
It is February, to be fair.
Yeah, I went to a bit of a commercial runs water and still struggled.
Oh, wow. Yeah, well.
Yeah, to be fair, there was still ice on a lot of the lake and there was a couple of the lads down there and they didn't catch anything either. And there was a nice calf on site with a cracking bacon and sausage sandwich. So I was shaking the cobwebs off more to be out than anything else. I didn't put 100% effort in, to be honest. I was just out there.
I've been on a cleanse since the last show. I did one of those 9-day courses where you don't eat anything. I felt good, actually, I have to say. I ate tablets and shakes. And then, the first 2 days I wasn't allowed to eat anything. And after that, I was allowed 800 calories a day, I think, which is, it's not easy to do. My sort of normal lunch, which would be a chicken and bacon sarnie from Tesco's with a pack of crisps and a drink, that's like 800 calories, which is
I can do 800 calories in a mouthful.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it was tough, but I lost over half stone.
And nice.
I felt energised. I really felt up for doing stuff. And I went to Ireland playing poker the weekend after the cleanse, and I had a fry up in the airport in the morning, and I felt lethargic all weekend.
It's amazing. After your fry up?
Yeah, well, I had two Chineses as well.
is this a confessional now?
Well, there was a few breakfasts, and it was. I put a couple of pounds back on. I mean, I didn't do it really to lose weight. It was, I fancied just being healthier because I live a pretty unhealthy lifestyle. I'm up late at night playing poker most nights of the week, or when I've been working and stuff, and I just don't live a very healthy lifestyle. So it was just a bit of a reset and then make an effort to stay healthy afterwards. And I'm doing it. I've just finished me fruit shake today. I'm trying to have shakes in the daytime, like sort of fresh fruit, protein powder, and then just one meal in the evenings and try and keep that up for a while. It's working. Feel okay.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I'll tell you what, about 6 months ago now, I changed job, packed in taxi driving to a job working in a shop. Went on my feet all day for being sat on my backside. And not changed my diet in any way, shape or form, but just that one change. I mean, I've never weighed myself, but just looking at my belt, it's slack. I know I've lost quite a bit of weight and I'm feeling a damn sight better and all. I can run upstairs and I'm not puffing and panting at the top now, which is a side effect of sitting on your backside for a living.
Well, I broke my belt just before I went to Ireland. I got this belt from the Pasha shop in Ibiza years ago. It's got like a big brass sort of cherry on the front of it on a metal bit. And I was having a wee in the toilet and it in a restaurant as well. And it pinged off the front and fell down the loo. Just had a pee. So I wasn't sticking my hand in to get it back. So that kind of spurred me on for the cleanse. So I feel better. I'm telling myself I've lost a few inches, and which wasn't the actual purpose. Yeah. I'm not like fat. you know, fat, fat. I'm just not healthy.
Yeah, so, that's, I've never been, I'm like just sort of 6.5 foot tall, and I have been over 20 stone. It was round about the Elstow days where, well, you know what my diet was there. It was tins of some pasta la vista stuff and burgers for breakfast. And, you know, I was big, but I just couldn't care less what I looked like. I've never been one for wondering what other people think. But when you start getting older and you start feeling, like you said, lethargic and out of breath, and I don't want to be like that, because, you know, that top secret park lake I've been having a dabble on, yeah, there's a lot of long walks involved. And
yeah, I did.
I want to do them in one.
It's always that feeling. I mean, I don't fish every week now like I used to, but, you know, when we were pretty hardcore travelling and you'd get a syndicate for the year and I'd fish three nights pretty much every week, or certainly 3 weeks a month. I always remember this time of year, you're sort of gearing up for your first session and you get that barrow out. I'd normally go and do a warm-up session just somewhere, you know, a runs water or something, just to make sure you've got enough lead, you know, you find out all the stuff you need for the coming season, basically. It's just like a recce trip.
Yeah, shake the cobwebs off and...
Shake the cobwebs off, get used to it. And I always remember the feeling of pushing your barrow full of gear for the first time of the season.
it's not good, is it?
No, you've gone 40 yards and you're out of breath and you can't walk. And then, like, by about the fourth session, because you normally do a move or two during the session, you may shoot off around the other side of the lake because, you know, you've set up, especially in February, March when you start fishing and there's not generally a lot happening. And it kills you for, like, the first three or four sessions. And then generally, like, your barrow just seems light because you've just developed the muscles again. And I'm dreading it this year. It's been a few years since. And I do intend on doing a bit of fishing. I remember when I fished the Cheshire Park Lake that I had the 50 coming out of a couple of years ago now. I mean, that there was a hell of a lot of walking there because you weren't really... In fact, I'll be careful what I say here, because Miles is up in court for catching said fish. Miles Gibson, if you didn't know.
Yeah, he went down and gave St. Ives a caning after that, didn't he?
He did, yeah, very good angler. But you know, I allegedly fished the same lake and I may have allegedly caught the fish. But there was 4 or 5 miles a day walking virtually every day. I lost a stone while I was doing it, and all your gear's carried on your back, so obviously you've gone as lightweight as possible, but you've still got unhooking mats, scales, cameras, rods, reels, you know, absolute essentials. And it's amazing, you know, how fit you can get just from sort of carp fishing. And
yeah, I remember back on the Pit 2 Elstow days, I never used a barrow on that lake, and when I think back now, you know, it's...
Wow, that far bank on there.
If you were walking around to the back bay, it's an endurance test.
Yeah, especially if that field had been ploughed or whatever.
Or it was wet because it's clay and you're growing half an inch with each footstep as all the muck sticks to your feet. And
yeah, it's pretty hard on that lake. Yeah. Elstow too.
Yeah. I mean, I even remember the session where I finally nailed the twin. That day, I moved from the back bay to the swim of the right of the snags. It weren't really a swim, just a gap in the hedges. And you're paddling through about a foot of water for quite a way. So I was in shorts, just, you know, carried my trainers with all my gear. I got to the other side. I didn't stop to put my trainers on because I was on a mission. I just carried on all the way up the slope, all the way to... And you know how many brambles and stuff around there? My feet were ripped to shreds by the time I'd got there, but... Okay. When you got the blinkers on, you're single-minded. I'd already seen the twin feeding on that margin spot. I was going to be there.
Yeah.
Had to be there.
It was an exciting old lake when it only had a few fish in it. If you got a chance of being on any fish, you know, you were... The adrenaline was pumping for sure.
Oh, you're not kidding. And that second full year I did, I was lucky because I was the only midweeker regular. There were still people having holidays and coming down fishing midweek. I didn't have it all my own way. But there was between, you know, 8 and 12 people on every weekend, because I knew a few of them, I was still in touch. And midweek, I was the only regular.
Yeah.
And I caught quite a few fish, thankfully, including the one I really wanted.
The twin. But, yeah, your email name used to be Twin Stalker.
It still is. I don't use that one. It's a bit embarrassing now after all this time when people think I'm some sort of weirdo, but...
Stalking twins.
Yeah.
How was the... you went to the Alan Blair Frank Warwick show as well, didn't you, over your way?
I did, yeah. That was a good night. Very entertaining. Caught up with quite a few friends, as you do at dudes like this. That's probably the main attraction for me, seeing people I've not seen for quite a while. But...
Frank's a funny guy as well, isn't he?
Oh, he's a funny. His show is brilliant. I remember I've seen him once before. It was one of Roger and yourselves duels at the Cresta Court, is it, in Manchester you had?
Yeah.
And, he's funny. And he was just going through old stories, a few of his Romanian stories. And I've got to say to anyone listening to this, if you get a chance to see Frank Warwick do a slideshow, go along because you will be entertained.
Yeah, he's funny. He's like a superhero abroad as well. I went to Romania with Nash a couple of years ago.
He has got that look.
He's got the porn star look. No, we do hope to get Frank on the show at some point as well. Cause
that will be good.
We'd like a few of his stories. But yeah, went over to Romania and we drove. So we went through loads of countries on the way, met people from all over the place. And there's like big billboards with Rob Hughes and Frank's pictures on it. You know, they're really, really famous in those countries, like really famous. Fishing is especially in Romania, it's kind of like a family pastime, you know, on bank holidays, because they eat carp over there traditionally and other fish. There's lots and lots of commercial waters where they go catch and eat. You know, there's like barbecues in every peg. And, you know, a lot of them now, like the decent lakes, they have two lakes. So they have one where you can do that, you know, go catch and eat. And then they have a catch and release lake as well, which is the place I went to. I think it was called Two Brothers. Quite a well-known match lake. Match fishing's big over there as well for carp. Like literally, you can do the match circuit and make a living off it. Like the sort of the course match circuit in this country.
Yeah, a few of the... top matchmen do over here. I'm not sure the carp matches, but before I moved house, the fella Andy I used to live next door does quite a lot on the match circuit. And I was chatting to him a while back, and I thought, I hope his missus doesn't hear this, but he showed me his little notebook, you know, because he's kept all his weights and dates and winnings and that. I think he did something, it was like $8,500 he'd won over a year. He works full time as a prison officer, so he's not at him all the time, but that's a lot of money.
Well, some of these in Romania, you can win $8,000 a week. You know, like the first...
I'm in the wrong job.
The first prizes, yeah. They have different rules as well. That they it's quite common to have... I think they take your best five fish. So if you catch 50 fish, but they're all £8, it's your top five weights that kind of go to the final. So you could be in another peg, but you have three 40-pounders. Those, you know... you will win by quite a margin, which I quite like.
It's a different way of just an all-in weight, isn't it?
Yeah, but like I say, it's quite big over there. I think there's stuff most weeks, you know, carp fishing. A lot of long range, so some very good anglers over there. They were a lot more up-to-date than I imagined them being in Romania. But like I say, it's part of their culture over there. I mean, they have a fishing and hunting channel, which is on terrestrial TV.
Yeah,
but it runs over like the whole of Europe. This channel, bank holidays, they all go to the lake, and you know the women sunbathe by the side of the lake, daughters, whatever. And they have caravans and big four wheel drives and all sorts. And it was really nice to see. Actually, like I say, it's part of their culture.
Yeah, when you say caravans and A1, no, it just reminded me of the A1 pits. That
it is kind of like that. Where you can just drive around. Yeah, if I was to design a day ticket lake in this country. That's exactly how I would do it, you know, that being able to take all the kit, be comfortable and drive around the lake is just very common abroad.
Yeah, if I had a lake, I'd be greedy and not let anyone fish till I'd caught everything myself. And then when they grew, I'd close it again.
I was just going to say, you'd be dead before you've caught one.
That's fair enough.
PVTV, that fishing and hunting.
PVTV.
Channel. Yeah, it's quite big. It's like, runs across quite a few countries. But yeah, it's terrestrial as well, so like everybody gets it. Let's move on to the interview and welcome Ali into the conversation. How are you?
I'm good, Jamie. How are you?
I know. Yeah, it's been a while. I know you've had a busy day today. You've been meeting celebrities and stuff, have you? That's your life these days?
No, not really my life. I was supposed to meet celebrities today, but like when you're dealing with celebrities, often things get changed at the last minute. So we were supposed to be interviewing Dappy today in the build-up for the Big Fish Off, doing some sort of exclusive promo interviews, really, to find out a little bit behind the scenes about them. Because you know what anglers are like? They're very quick to criticise some of the celebrities that we film with and don't take them too seriously as anglers, but some of these people love it so much, and I want some of that to come across. That's what the interviews are for.
I've never understood that. Like, just because somebody's job might put them in the public eye, like, why wouldn't their hobby, why wouldn't they be just as passionate about a hobby as we are, or to any other next man, you know? I've seen him, saw Dappy on Big Brother talking with Jim Davidson about fishing and stuff, and they're both, you know, the pair of them, they're super keen anglers. They love it. So I don't understand why you could think somebody is a... somebody who's extremely successful in their own business might be crap at something else just because they're famous.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, some of them are really crap. But great thing, what I love about it is we're trying to put fishing on a more fashionable map. I know a lot of people, and don't get me wrong, I've got nothing against people, if you like, that sort of subsurface crew, if you like, that are trying to keep it real and keep it cool and keep it underground. But I'm the total opposite. I'm trying to make it overground, really, and get more buy-in from youngsters. And I think having the celebrity people endorsing the sport is the way for it to go, for it to be seen as more fashionable. Because I don't want to be seen as a boring old man, you know. I want to be seen as someone cool and trendy that does a sport that is trendy, not like, oh, what a saddo going fishing, because I don't believe it is.
That's how it used to be, you know. You used to be embarrassed to tell people, yeah, I go fishing, you know, fishing.
Yeah, especially, fishing. Yeah.
Especially like, you know, in the sort of other side of your life and my life, you know, that we go out, you know, I've DJed in clubs from, you know, places for 20-odd years. And
not a good chat, Ryan, is it, Jamie?
No, yeah. Oh, what, you're a fisherman?
Yeah.
You know, no, but it's cool,
it
it's really cool.
Chat up line.
Yeah, all the carp anglers, you know, they take a crate of beer and a tub of wacky backy and they sit in a tent for 4 days, you know. Oh, yeah. What, that's cool.
Yeah, exactly. So we're trying to, that's basically, I mean, I want fishing to be opened up, because I gave a quote for a local paper the other day and I said, there's very few sports where you go from total solitude and tranquility to total bedlam in like a split second. You know, I mean, I don't know many sports or hobbies that can offer that. Can you?
No, without doubt. Because like I say, the stereotype is, you know, sitting there on a little wicker basket watching a float, you know,
all day.
Yeah, that's it. You know, it's not, you know, we've got iPhones, iPads on stands by the side of the thing, rechargeable batteries, and, you know, you sit there watching porn for 12 hours and occasionally your alarm might go off and you're winding a chunk.
Yeah, exactly. But this show, we're trying to open up all sorts of fishing, like how we started. And the challenges that we do, they go up the size spectrum. So I think it shows that you can have as much action as you want or as little action as you want based on what you want to get out of your fishing. And that's what I always try to get across. If you know, I know your type of fishing. I mean, you get to a stage in your carp fishing, for example, where you almost get bored of getting bites, don't you? And you want to sit out and wait for the dream fish, where, you know, a lot of people enjoy getting bites. That's what they go for, and it's that adrenaline rush. And I think it's important to show the whole spectrum of it, because I think there is something for everyone in fishing, and the stereotype shows just one type of fisherman, doesn't it? The guy sitting there catching nothing, and that isn't the sport.
So for people that don't know, I'm sure there's the odd person that hasn't seen the marketing PR. What we're talking about here in this TV show is the Big Fish Off. Tell us exactly the kind of, you know, the premise for the show.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, with Corder and everything, we've had Thinking Tackle and Fishing Gurus with our sister brand Guru running on Sky Sports now. Thinking Tackle enters its 10th year. Fishing Gurus enters its sixth year. So, you know, real progression there. But I wanted to get a show that would be good for the mainstream audience, that basically you could sit and watch with your wife, your girlfriend, your grandma, your children, and all of you get some entertainment out of it rather than it being a one-way shop. And myself and the director, Nick, who worked on, Dancing on Ice, he's worked on Come Dine With Me, a proper top-end TV director, but he was an angler. And I got to meet Nick, he's been directing the Thinking Tackles, and together we came up with this concept of the Big Fish Off, which was, we put a couple of proposals to ITV, a few different ones, a couple of them that could come to fruition in the future, but they obviously liked this one because it was a real sort of in between, I'm a Celebrity and Big Brother and all these things where you get sort of celebrities in isolation somewhere with the challenges. And they liked this whole thing of me and Dean up against each other as team captains. So each episode, we toss a coin, I get one celebrity, he gets the other, and then we've got three different fishing challenges, so best of three, if you like. And you get the undertone of the Olympian, David and Goliath, all that sort of stuff between me and him, and then you get the celebrities. It's very frustrating not being able to put your hand on the rod a lot of times and trying to teach someone to cast there and do that, and you can imagine, can't you? But it's real funny, a lot of banter. You see basically all the other stuff apart from the serious stuff, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be on ITV. I mean, it's a great move getting the last person that had a commercial fishing program, probably Robson Green, and before that, when I was a kid, I would say.
Well, that's been a huge success. Robson Green show on, Extreme Fishing was massive. I mean, he's even heard about this. He's been talking about the Big Fish Off in interviews and stuff like that. So it's quite a compliment that the word, has rippled into the TV world. But, the one I think that's given us the best chance was River Monsters. I think the success of that, coming in from a scientific angle, not really being pitched as a fishing show, has actually helped the industry in total get the chance, because it's opened up the doors to fishing, because extreme fishing come off the back of that, I would say. And I think the Big Fish Off as well, we had ears pricked up. We were able to engage with the commissioning editors and actually have a conversation and not be laughed at the office. And I think that, I've got to, shake Jeremy Wren for that, because I think his success with that show definitely helped us.
Yeah, and, as big as, it's probably one of the better fishing programs that's ever been done, the Jeremy Wade one, but it's still not terrestrial TV like ITV4,
River Monsters on ITV, isn't it?
Oh, so it moved,
Jeremy, it was Discovery back in the day, but no, Jeremy is on, he's on ITV, it goes out on ITV4 originally, which is the Factual Entertainment channel, which is why we're on ITV4, it doesn't go in like a ratings order, it doesn't go 2, 3, 4, they're all different genres, them channels. Obviously, one is the creme de la creme, the best shows from those selection of networks will make ITV1. But River Monsters, it runs for an hour on ITV4, but then they put, a cut-down half-an-hour version on ITV1. That's how he runs. But Jeremy's turned into a bit of a megastar off the back of it, He's become, he's huge in America, everywhere. He's such a buy-in to the concept of it.
Oh, and, definitely. We've been trying to book him for the Northern Angling Show for 2 years now. He's always filming somewhere. He wants to come. He sent his brand last year doing all the sort of books and stuff and all the literature that he does and videos. But we're still struggling to get him. He's everywhere.
The long shoots as well, I think, because the type of television that he makes, compared to the Big Fish Off, we have a period of a show, we know how long the show takes. It's actually the post-production after that takes the bulk of the time. It takes so long. But Jeremy's, he's there for a long time, because to get the shots, I mean, I've seen parts of his shows that last about 30 seconds, but I know that's taken him probably a day to film that, to get all the angles. And that costs money and takes up a lot of time. So, I know, I can feel his pain, so I know.
And what's of all the, tell us who all the guests are. We know where Dappy obviously been mentioned.
Yeah, right. So the first show, and again, someone I think he's had a fair bit of flack when we had him on Thinking Tackle off a few haters, if you like. But Mick Norcross, of Towie fame. But the thing about Mick is he's a proper man's man. Loves the farming background, engineering, working on the docks. He's really, he's had a rise to prominence, and really Towie's a tiny percentage of the man behind the man, really. he's been a great help. He helped a lot in actually getting the guest that joins him in that first episode, which is Tamir Hassan, the famous actor from The Business, Bonded by Blood. Great actor, and he is gold on this show. I really, when I worked with him, I kind of realised why we paid him what we did, and also, you know, why he's a professional actor, because he just got it. You know, he just knows how to play the camera. He's fantastic to work with.
And what's Tamer like as an angler? Is he as keen as, say, I know Dappy's super keen. Is Tamer
never fished in his life, mate?
He's a complete non-angler.
The third show. Yeah, he was, from the whole series, the only person that had never fished. We got him on because we wanted someone that Mick had a rapport with, and we just thought it would be it'd be a good show, and we could have this whole, you know, one of them being a non-angler, the other being an angler. It makes a good spin for it, and we learned very on whether it was good to learn whether we could actually get someone who's never fished to like the sport, and that's the interesting spin of that first show.
What did he catch? What was his first fish, and what was the look on his face like?
At the first challenge we did, we went up the size spectrum. So obviously this is the show you're going to see next week. It's, the 11th of February, Wednesday, just in case this goes out another time. And, the first challenge was a golden rod challenge. How many rods each team could catch in 60 minutes? Kind of like what you used to do with your mates when you were little. But being at Angler's Paradise, it weren't normal rod. They're all bright and wonderful colours down there. So it's golden rod. And then we progressed up the size spectrum. We went onto the koi lake, and it wasn't about the numbers of the fish you're going to catch. It's actually about, it was something else. It was another spin on it, more about, you know, the koi with the most colours, you know, rather than just to make it a bit more interesting. And the last challenge, we actually get the Hollywood actor to camp out in a bivvy, which is quite funny. But it moves very quickly, the show. It zips along. It's not something that gets bogged down in sort of technical sections. The technical sections are there for the anglers, but they're kept very short. So if you're a fisherman, you know what we're talking about. And if you're a non-angler, you're not going to get bored by it. So that's the balance we had to strike. But Tamer loves it. And that first fish, even though it was like a three-inch rod, I think whet his appetite from there on in.
Yeah, my first ever fish was a perch about 4 inches long, same as most people's first perch probably, but it was a big deal, you know. I remember I was excited, I remember it, and I just wondered if an adult gets that same kind of buzz, you know, as we did as kids.
Yeah, I think that for that show, Tamer got, in that first challenge especially, it was two-pronged. You got the whole idea of him catching his first fish, but I think he also got dragged into the competition element, which made every rod very special.
I bet, yeah. How did your fishing journey start? I mean, who took you first of all, when, where?
I grew up in, it's funny, I'm back in Colchester now, but I lived away, as you know, from when I moved up north in 98, when I come up to uni in Manchester. I lived up there till 2005 when I went back to Colchester when I joined Corder, because I thought I'd go to my hometown. It was only an hour away. But yeah, I actually moved to Colchester originally in 1985. It was the year we moved to England, really. So my fishing started in 91. A kid from school, just a lad from primary school, took me eel fishing like a dirty plug. I've actually written in my next book that's hopefully going to come out this year, I've written that whole chapter, you know, the whole beginning of how it started. But yeah, we went eel fishing down a little just a little spit of lake off the River Colne, so salt water. It was a brackish water lake, that one. And I remember float fishing once, right, the first time I went on my own after he showed me, and the float, I couldn't work out whether I needed to hit the float when it went under or when it went up. And there was a couple of times this float was under, and I mean, mate, it was under for about 10 minutes. And then it came back up. And in the end, so I've had a couple of them. Finally, one felt so sorry for me that obviously it hung itself long enough that when I went to find out what was going on, there was one on the end, and I worked out that I was supposed to hit it when the float went under. So That was where it all started, and then it was hand lining for rod in the close season on the local pits. Oh, sorry, babes.
And where was the transition to carp? Where did that come?
that came, funnily enough, quite early in my year. I stayed as like a hybrid angler for a while, not hybrid species, but actually a cross between the two. But what happened was that complex of lakes in Wivenhoe that I fished, it's actually come on to quite a venue now. I mean, Joe Morgan caught a 40-pounder out of there. But back then, there was few lakes, small fish, and also big fish in them. So you used to have your carp rod out as the sleeper rod and then your float rod. And it was basically one winter I was there, and I just chucked a carp rod out in this swim. My dad had bought me my first bag of boilies, and been poulting these out all day, mate, right? And I've had a churner. Now, this lake was really hard. There was only about 50 carp in it back then, and you say seven acres in the winter, you know, you're fishing for the first time. Anyway, so I've caught this fish, low double, still my biggest carp ever. Next cast, caught a 16-pounder, right? And for this lake, that is massive, right? It was a massive fish for that lake back then, because I think the record was just over 20. Anyway, so I've been catapulting these boilies out all day, right? And I look in the margins, mate, and they're all floating in. My dad had bought me a bag of floaters. So they were officially my first ever zig carp. They were caught on like 12-inch Dacron hook link straight off the lead.
Popped up straight off the lead, wow.
Yeah, boom, there you go, mate. There's a lesson in there early on. So that was that.
I did that when I was a kid. We used to, you know, deliberately pop up bread and stuff off the hook link, but I'd get the takes. I could never hook them. I'd obviously dodgy rigs, and I'm probably a bit older than you as well, so maybe 80s.
Not that much older, but yeah, you're probably wiser.
I'm not sure. 82, 83, something like that. But I remember getting the bites. I could never hook them when I popped them up off the lead. Like, we were like connect. You know, usually connected. It was no hair rigs then. Well, I think it was about 83-ish. Used a hair rig for the first time after reading it somewhere or seeing it, but I could never hook him, so you were doing better than me from the off. You were
I think one of the other reasons I was doing so well with it was with after each fish, what was happening, I was like, the boilie was like breaking the ready tied rig's hair off, so I was re-tying the loop into the Dacron, so the hair was getting tighter and tighter. So it was a perfect zig setup by default. Didn't even realise. Little 14mm pop up on a size 8 super specialist, probably on a black Dacron hook link. Perfect.
What's your most successful method now? Or do you still use zigs a lot? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone knows that I love zigs. They've seen it on Thinking Tackle, and I actually. You know what, over the years, the more you learn about fish scientifically, the more you sort of philosophical you get in the type of fishing that you do. And I do believe, and even just watching fish, they spend so much time off the bottom, you actually start to go, well, the only reason they ever go to the bottom really is to feed in general conditions, or to maybe lay and rest, you know. Apart from that, they spend the most of the time marauding around at all different depths. So last year on Bayswater, for example, in the winter, I only did two nights on that syndicate. That's how much, you know, people think I fish all the time. The only personal fishing I did last year were two nights, one in February, one in March, single nights. And I caught a fish on each night just on little three-foot zigs, straight off the lead in sort of like 10 foot of water, just to give you an idea. And that, you know, in that sort of early, that cusp of like late winter, early spring, where they're just waking up, and I think they start marauding around looking for some blossoming natural food that isn't there yet. That's, you know, something blatant in their face like that just nicks them, you know. And I really, mate, it was proper chuck it in chance fishing as well. I was just casting the rod around until I got a nice drop that I was happy with on one rod, another one in slightly sludgier stuff, and just, yeah, 3 foot, like 7 pound hook link, a Fox Zigger liner, a size 8 mixer, and I had my foam dried in a bit of caramel goo, and that was that. And they were both nights. They went. I had just a bite out of the blue on each rod. Like, really weird, isn't it? That, you know,
I keep meaning to like devote a whole season to zigs. Fish all rods on zigs for the entire year.
And you can't do as many as you do now, mate, without a doubt, if not more.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, the bait companies probably don't want to hear that. Because,
Yeah, foam don't make people a lot of money. But, yeah, you tapping. You're tapping into the natural behaviour of fish, aren't you? You know, that's what I say. They spend the bulk of their time off the deck.
Yeah, they drop to ease. It's that simple. You know,
yeah. Make them do that more than anything, don't we? It's our constant baiting. I mean, there isn't that abundance of natural food laying on the bottom all the time. We force them down there a lot of the time. You know, a lot of the clear spots that have been formed in lakes have been created by man, really, with their baiting more than anything. You know, a lot of the lakes. Bait on top of bait on top of bait on top of bait, and they bore them out. Of course, you've got your natural holes and, you know, your muscle craters and things that form, but a lot of the lakes you go to, the clear spots in the weed are often formed by man, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Like I say, there's food in weed, which is various different depths, but obviously I mean, they are bottom feeders. There's lots of stuff, natural stuff on the bottom, but
yeah,
they go down when they're hungry. It's that catching them in between. I mean, if I see a fish show, I cast a rig to it, you know, try and feel for a bump in the general area, and you know, I'm reasonably confident of it going. Some really good zig anglers that I know up here fish the Manchester Park Lake and stuff, they're on the zigs a long time ago, and their first reaction if they see a fish jump is to throw a zig out.
Totally, mate. I am of that ilk. I'm not one of these people that labels methods with. I hate people, you know, like the old people, like, oh, it's caught off the top, doesn't count, caught it on a zig, doesn't count, caught it on a pop-up, you know, that's you know, without swearing, that is absolute baloney.
Yeah, you can swear, yeah. By the way, we're not.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'm trying to be polite, mate, you know. it is garbage, that, really, because end of the day, you're there as the sort of hunter-gatherer type person, and you just got to do what it takes to get the bite, you know, without endangering the fish. And zigs, I have caught literally, mate, so many, and I am thankful for the fact that I grew up on the lake that they were pretty much developed on, layer pits, and so I got to use them early. So I never had that confidence barrier, which so many people have with them.
We'll be seeing the cord of spear next.
No, yeah, the Hamidi Asian spear, the Persian print.
any methods count.
Yeah, none of that. But yeah, I'm totally with you, mate. I think if someone used the zigs, I think the only time if someone said to me, when would you not use a zig? I would say back end of summer, beginning of autumn, when they really are, when fish are beginning to be pinned to the deck. But as soon as you've had them first few hard frosts, and the firmer clines are just, that is, you know, Ziggy Stardust time for me.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like, on every lake, the first X amount of bites on a lake will come off the zig. You know, when we used to fish on the bottom as sort of standard, like, you think the lake would wake up, you know, end of March or whenever it was. The lads that I know are really good on the zigs, they're fishing the zigs from, you know, February, from as soon as they're out.
Yeah.
And the first 10, 20, 30 bites of, you know, said lake are all on zigs, and we weren't even fishing from on zigs. You know, they don't drop for quite some considerable time, you know.
Yeah.
There's a window at the start. I think there's a window in, you know, prime time in sort of May where they really want to try.
Oh, that's killer zig time, I think. Up until they spawn, mate, I found once they've spawned, they can be, in springtime, you'll catch all day on zigs, day and night, right? But once they've spawned, I've found that's a period of time where you do get lulls on the zig action, almost like feeding spells, because they unless you follow them up and down constantly, and then you adjust to bottom baits, and then you come out, there are parts of the day when they're just not having it at all, you know, and they are sunbathing, you know, they are doing whatever they're doing, and you just can't get to them, you can't irritate them enough. But that just comes, I think people find that out. But if someone chucks a zig out for the first time, then they can get a very clouded viewpoint of the method, which is a shame. You know, they need to, like anything, you can only draw a conclusion fairly if you use it and analyse it for long enough.
That's why I said if I ever do it, I'm going to do the whole season. You know, I'm not just going to half-heartedly pop a rod out every now and again when nothing's going on the bottom.
Yeah, give it an hour.
Give it a full season. Give it a full season, and then actually study it. You know, we know when the most common bite times on the bottom are, right? We know that it's your first light, and you know, autumn it tends to be in the night and tea time. You can set your watch by them sometimes on lakes. We only know that from years of experience of actually doing it. So, I think to understand zigs the same way You may be able to fine-tune the pair of them. You go, right, well, the peak time on Ziggs is 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. I'm going to fish bottom rods all the other hours and Ziggs between those times. You know, without doing it over a period of time, I think...
Yeah, I think on your venue, obviously it'll vary from lake to lake, but if you're campaigning on a particular place, and, you know, it's got to be a certain depth for Ziggs to be worthwhile anyway, you know, you get, you know, no point fishing a Zig in 3 foot, you know, you're fishing a pop-up off a little, aren't you? So, yeah. You know, you're talking your lake 6-7 foot plus, really, where they, from now, that height onwards, they do come into their own, I think.
Do you think it's, say you take a 3 foot lake, I don't know if you've sort of fished any lakes that are, you know, sub 4 foot, generally, yeah, all over, but do you just think the fact that obviously when you're bottom fishing in that depth, it's still kind of in front of them wherever they go? Do you think it's just a curiosity?
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I mean, when we did underwater 7 and 8 and we had the wafter hook baits on with the when we started applying without getting too pluggy, without when we started applying that almond goo to it, they were coming over the top and they were diving down from sort of 4 foot,
yeah,
nosing straight into the hook bait. You know, veering almost like someone had pulled them down with a magnet. So I do think if the hook bait's right and it's attractive enough that they, you can, in them sort of depths, you can pull them down, whatever the weather. But there was a couple of days, you know, like when it was really flat calm and the fish ghosted over the spot and there was nothing that would attract them. And I did think there, if you're willing to sacrifice sort of the disturbance of putting a rod back out and messing up what was sat there all cocked waiting for him to come back. If you had a pop-up off the lead there, 2-3 foot, you would have caught fish without a doubt.
What's the best of all the goos?
It's like rigs, mate, you know. It's like anything. Because the thing people don't realise about them is they're all totally different. There's a lot of combinations. Some of the things we don't even know. I mean, Ian Huntington, which you know well from your region, yeah, you know, Pete and Ian are renowned, and they would never ever be using anything that's shit. And it, you know, Ian behind it is probably the biggest compliment I could give it ever. The fact that he was the one who brought it into the country and started using it from South Africa. But one thing I've learned about him is that combinations are deadly. And as our understanding, which ones are best in different temperatures. And that's one of the things. The ones that say supreme on the bottle, they're generally of a runnier nature, which help penetrate into the centre of the bait. And that, I think, for the English angler who likes to have a bait out for a long time, that is much more suited to us. You know, we've been used to soaking pop-ups in combinations of flavours and stuff for years. So culturally, that isn't a big step. I think few of the... I don't know, the old school who were suddenly thinking they're going to have fluorescent hazes of green spooking fish away. Total garbage, mate. That just doesn't happen. You know, I've witnessed it with my own eyes, and obviously I've fished so hard with the stuff for 3 years. I wouldn't use it on every thinking tackle and every show I do if it was crap. You know, it's because, like anything that's in your armory or my armory or any good angler's armory, they do it because they believe that's the best thing for the job, and that's it. So, like any, you know, like a rig, if I said to you, Jamie, what's your best rig? You'd say whatever's best for that situation.
Of course,
would you?
Yeah. It's the same.
It's a similar thing, mate, yeah. Like a matchman, really. I have a few, but if someone said, like, what would you do? I'd say get a little selection, a couple of different colours, a couple of different consistencies, and just have a play. And it's the same as you and I when we go fishing with rigs. Probably got, you know, our best four, if you like, under our sleeve for different scenarios, and we just apply them when the situation suits.
Definitely. Did you, you had a lot of success on the Manor down your neck of the woods in Essex. You used to go on there, and how was...
No, it wasn't actually out then. No, I didn't use it at all. I did quite a few different things on the Manor. Again, very similar concept to how I fish. When I started writing this second book, mate, and I tracked back for all my, you know, my best captures over the years, and I'll have it right as well, mate, I have never ever fished for more than 20 years personally a season, ever. And I mean, I can track back to when I was a student, and one of the things this book's about is about maximizing your time on the bank through tactical nous, as opposed to just being there and existing, you know, being a full-time bandit. I'm trying to inspire the working man to think that he can go to a lake with a target fish and achieve what someone who might be doing 4 or 5 nights a week can achieve by being a little, you know, having a slant. And on the Manor, the sort of I had probably like a season's worth of fish in two or three nights, just overnighters, because it was all about the preparation before the session. Yeah. So what I did is I studied the lake, and I could see that certain swims were getting neglected because it was just fashionable to follow in after in after in. And basically, even on a small lake like that, lake swims were getting overlooked. And I was just going down on a Tuesday. So if I was fishing on a Thursday night, I would go down on a Tuesday lunchtime, because it's only about 11 minutes from Corder. If there was only a couple of people on the lake, so it was quiet and I wasn't going to affect anyone's fishing, I would lace in a bit of bait along that margin, get back on it 48 hours later. When I went 48 hours later, I had a bucket of bait that had been in the lake water for that period of time as well. So all my loose feed was soft. Yeah. So I'm not saying this is the other thing with washed out baits. People think they're taking them because the carp think they've got less flavour in and they're safer. They're not. I think they like washed out baits just because they're soft and easy to eat, and the manor carp are old and they like an easy meal. So my bait was nice and soft, and then my hook bait over the top. This is what I was saying. I learned through all my good captures through the book when I was writing, they were all caught on cherries on the cake, as opposed to match the hatch hook baits. Everything, all right, they were either caught on snowmen with a yellow one over the top, an IB, or in this case on the Essex Manor, I was using some homemade cell cork balls, but I'd actually added a tiny bit of colour, which had sort of turned them a slightly orange tinge, if you like, a brown orange, and just boosted the levels. I'd put 15 mil of cell into one egg as opposed to four eggs, plus a multi-stim as well, an appetite stimulant. So it's amazing, you know, when you write something like that, and it's the first time you actually statistically go back through all your captures and how you caught them, and then you go, bloody hell, I caught everything. Even a 70-pounder out of Gigantica, over bait, where I had a straight bottom bait over the top, and a 25 mil orange Scopex and peach wafter over the top. That's the one.
Just about. So it's pretty light. It's balanced, basically.
Yeah. But it was the one. It was the bright one. I mean, even at night, that was, mate. You know, it was the bright, higher track bait that got taken by the big un. And I know if you were campaigning, I was there for longer, and I've seen it on the weeks when we film in France and stuff like that, that matching the hatch sort of comes into its own towards the back end of the week once the fish have been on a boilie or a food source for a prolonged period. But early on in a session, and the type of fishing that I do, which is 24 hours to 72 hours tops, I never deviate from that now. And when you analyse it statistically, you'd be mad to.
Yeah, I once worked out that all my best seasons had come when I was using balance baits. You know, I went through seasons of using bottom baits, you know, I was obsessed about trying to get it to look identical, you know, hook bait to look the same as the feed bait. And then I've gone the other way. Once I'd worked it out, my best seasons where I caught the most fish were always when I was using balanced rigs, you know, really.
I remember you were like big with your, when you were using your, like, was it Scopex squid livers and that back in the day when you were on Elstow and bits like that? And you always, I remember talking to you when you were DJing and that, and you were always, it was always like a balanced snowman or something, wasn't it?
The slower it sank, the better it was. Yep. You know, if you did it perfectly, it was floating, but not coming up, you know. So once it took on a little bit of water, then it was down. Sinking slowly. Yeah, I'd spend ages, you know, 10-15 minutes getting it perfect, biting partly off and stuff. I did catch more fish.
Well, I did that with my pop-ups, you know, what you're saying there on the manor. I would just keep using, because there was a tiny bit of detritus on the bottom, I would almost have like a quarter of an inch pop-up, and I would take, like you say, sort of 10 minutes in the margins getting it just right, so it's just hovering on the brink of floating, and by the time it's gone in and taken on a tiny bit of water, it's down just how you want it. And that was, it's in your head a bit, but it makes you confident, doesn't it?
I remember fishing them all popped up one night when I'd actually had, because I used to critically balance them so finely, I used to have me pop-ups soaking in a dip, which made them heavier. So I'd critically balance them perfectly. And obviously as the dip's coming out when they're in the water.
Yeah, yeah, the buoyant, it's getting more buoyant.
It's getting more buoyant. I'd reel them in the morning. I always check them when I reel them in as well to see how much they've dropped overnight. And they were all popped up straight off the lead. I was like, no.
Yeah.
That was on Elstow 1, I think. I was just like, wasting.
You would have still got a bite though, mate, wouldn't you? If they were really tearing it up, you would have probably got a bite.
Well,
but weren't the end of the world.
Obviously, zigs are so common now that, I'm just thinking, when I reeled them in, I thought, I've just wasted a night's fishing. And knowing what we know now with the zigs, and they're quite happy to pick stuff,
Mate, the moving baits thing, I mean, it's like baits being taken off the deck, the amount of food that gets knocked off the deck when they're feeding. Like matchmen, like Adam Rooney, one of the fishing gurus this year, done something really interesting where he basically is feeding the pellet with the pole. But then every if he's not getting a bite every few minutes, what he does, he winds the rig about a foot back. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we can't do that on a weedy lake, but some of our, listeners here that might be fishing, a runs water that's got a nice clear bottom.
Yeah.
Wind the rig back a foot, mate, and he's getting...
It just lifts it up again and sinks.
Yeah, and it's pulling round. Within seconds, we caught it live on camera. He did it. Bang. Wrapped round straight away. Mad. But it's what people don't realise about carp is the more caught up they're getting it, the more serious they take the species, the more they put them on a pedestal of being this sort of crazy, clever creature. And they're just not, mate. They are absolute water pigs. And they're actually, I think, the fish with maybe some of the least guile compared to, some of the other species. And actually tapping into their animal instinct is a lot of what my philosophy is about when I fish. Thinking like them of, creating that sort of feeding frenzy and that excitement, and I don't think enough people do that. They get all caught up in the camo and the slack line and all of that stuff, treating them like a god, and they're not.
Yeah, it's the basics. And I always think when I try and think like a carp, you've got to just kind of equate it to something else. So it's like, there's a big wind banging up one end, but it's freezing cold. And I'm sitting there going, it's not very nice on the end of this wind. I'd be up the other end, and you go and check on the flat calm bit on the back of the wind. And there they all are, sat under a tree,
Exactly. If it's cold for you, mate, you can bet your bottom dollar it's bloody freezing for them. Because the difference of cold-blooded and warm-blooded is monumental, you're right. I mean, Gaz told me a few stories when he was fishing Cote Water Park, and he was on the end of a southwesterly rubbing his hands thinking he was being all clever, but actually it was stacked up off the back of it, and he moved over there and bang, I think come the winter times, the temperature thing, the water temperature element is the key, not where the wind's blowing.
Yeah, I actually believe, me and Mark were talking about this a little while ago, actually, I believe that water temperature has probably got more to do with us catching than
wind.
Anything else.
Without a doubt, mate. We took, by the time I was going a bit stir crazy when we were doing underwater 7 and 8, and I was, the best days, I was measuring the temperature every day in the morning and then in the, and basically when it was kicking off, mate, it was always on a spike. It was never on a decline. It was on the day I think we caught the big plated in the morning, the water temperature was 9. When we caught it, it was tipping 12, just to give you an idea. And they were going wild.
What's 12 in old money? That's 50, isn't it?
I don't know. But that's basically I was putting there. So it might not have been that temperature where the spot was, but I kept measuring it in the exact same spot in the swim. So I had a, a constant variable to measure. So that was the key. But I'm with you and Rog there, mate, without a doubt. Water temperature is king.
I took the 10 years ago on the wire up north, and 50 degrees, which I think is 12, that was the key. Whenever it hit 50 degrees, this is in March when it's been cold and it's
got a
sunny day and it was 50 for the day, and then if you got a frost that night, it dropped down to 47, 48. But whatever day, and the next day if it was cold, it never made the 50, it was 48, and nothing had happened. If it hit the 50, you'd see fish showing, or catch one even better,
That was I saw that. I mean, I could have drawn a graph, really, and I've covered that in my book about those days, really, the climbs in temperature, the difference it was making to the fish activity. At the same time, if you had 14 degrees and it dipped down to 12, that again is a problem. I always find that being cold-blooded, the dips in temperature can can aggravate them in those low bands. You know, in those low bands, there are times in the summer where it gets so warm that they are really
they're
relaxing. The sun's out. But I spoke to a couple of people, and they told me, you know, I spoke to a few fishery experts in other countries, and they believe that, you know, the carp in those countries that are used to like 28, that sort of temperature of water, they're feeding like mad all day long, mate, because they've just that's like a perfect temperature for the bodies, the enzymes, everything. Everything's working to its maximum.
Yeah, they've just got used to it. What I found going from the autumn into the winter, it was the first day it went cold that triggered the bite, you know. So if it'd been mild for a bit, sort of autumn going into winter, the first frost, bang, there was a load of fish out that day. If it go mild again for 2 or 3 weeks, the next time it goes cold, the first night, you know, drop below freezing, then it'd do a bite or two. It's almost like the opposite. It just triggers them. Shit, we've got to eat now. you know, it's getting cold. How's your social life these days? I know a few years ago when we were hanging about with Sam and stuff over in Ibiza, you were venturing your first trips to Ibiza with... did you not go on Danny's?
I went to Dan's wedding. Yeah, it's the only time I went over there. To be fair, it's quite scared me a bit. I thought, blimey, these people now at a party, looking at people walking down the street, looking like a ghost. I thought
you always like to go out.
I'll stick to me table service and relaxation in the more commercial places. No, it was good, mate. I went out there, yeah, with Dovey and. We saw Sam one night playing in Pasha. I thought that was amazing with Copyright. I think Bob Sinclair was headlining. But, watching Sam and his partner in crime. And I think, is it Shovel who smashes the old...
percussionist, he's amazing.
Yeah, he's brilliant. I got Sam to send me some of his stuff afterwards, and it never sounded as good on the iPod as it did in the club that night.
Yeah, there's reasons for that.
I told him that.
He's amazing. Was he in all his like Indian headgear and all that, and paints his face. Yeah. And he's a proper brilliant. Entertainer. He lives out there now, I believe.
It was good.
If you ever go again, they have... there's a beach up in the north called Beneras Beach. It's most people have been to Ibiza have never been to this place. It's amazing. But on a Sunday night, all the drummers go there, percussionists, Shovel goes, everybody, and the beach is just full of people playing drums. Like the whole,
that must be amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And like there's all like hippies round fires type things playing drums. But everywhere you look for like half a mile of beach, that's what's going on. And just all
that
you
sounds
hear.
Amazing. Yeah.
I think Shovel's got a song.
Sounds fun.
Shovel's got a song actually called "Drums of Beneras," I think, something like that. But yeah, I remember you used to like your nights out. We had a few nights out back in the day.
Yeah, another night out. As my missus always says, she says, "Don't think you'll ever get bored of this, will you?" I was like, "Well, probably not." I think lads and women are built differently, aren't they? I think I think women once they settle down and find the man they love or whatever, they're happy. The nest is being built, and blokes are just constantly they're like, you know. They're out, they love it being out with the lads, and I still love going out, to be honest, with my mates. Now, where fishing used to be the break for me, nowadays it seems like when I've had a... Because I don't drink in the week at all. I don't, you know, I live very healthy in the week. I train and go to the gym, eat well, and at the weekend, if I can, if I'm not away with work, you know, once, twice a month, I might get to go out. And that's the first time, I think, in a week, I don't think about work, or I have a little reboot where the system shuts down and gets restarted again. Yeah. So the nights out are integral with my sanity, without a doubt.
We had a few nights out in Liverpool, didn't we? Is that where you
were? Yeah, I used to drive, though, you know, when you were DJing. Because people don't realise, and I think back, that was in my early quarter years. I used to drive back up north to Mum and Dad's, come watch Liverpool at the weekend, and every Friday, without fail, I'd be like the old DJ's mate, wouldn't I, in the booth? I'd come up to see you.
Just taking the requests off the girls, that's what it was.
Yeah, more like taking your knock-ons. Yeah. Your flick-ons are all over the show, I was having them, yeah. It's all good. It's all good banter, mate. Never forget them days.
You used to call me the pre-baiter because I'd never made the killer move with the women. I'd just have been wording them for about a year and a half each one.
You got to dive in, ain't you, mate? Yeah, they're all your birds.
I like softly.
never. The long game, they call it on Kiss, don't they? He was playing the long game. Wow. Long game. I learned from a few mates, a few very good mates, the long game never works.
Well, yeah, you're probably right. We're both settled down now, so...
Yeah, exactly. Mate,
are you married, getting married, did I see?
Yeah, got married, mate. Got married June 25th. Last year, it all went in a bit of a blur, to be honest. I mean, I proposed to her a couple of years before on her birthday to Emma, and but after the wedding, it all went a bit. We had quite a few problems. My mum had like major heart surgery and stuff like that, and so I kind of didn't get to enjoy too much after the honeymoon because as soon as I come, my mum had actually delayed the operation.
Yeah.
Till we got back. So once I got back, it was straight down and with that, and then she was in intensive care for quite a while, and you know she's through the woods now. But yeah, that kind of soaked up the back end of that year, really. So it didn't, you know, like some people, you get married and then you have quite a relaxing sort of period afterwards. It wasn't really like that for me. I knew what was coming and, yeah, it turned out like that. So,
well, best wishes to your mum, of course.
Yeah, cheers, mate.
Where was the honeymoon? That wasn't when you went to Gillam's, was it, in Thailand?
No, that was the year before. We had a little holiday out there, to be fair. No, we actually went to Florida because we're originally going to go to California on a road trip. But we both really wanted to go to one of the Disney venues. But then our friends told us, man, Disneyland in LA is like really small. Disney World's like monstrous. So we ended up going to Orlando for like 6 nights. Then we drove down to Miami for 3 nights. Then I drove to Key West for 3 nights. That was brilliant. I loved Key West. We even got a day out shark fishing. And then a couple of nights back in Miami before we flew back to England. So it was a real good, good little trip. Had the old Chevy Camaro full of cases. We didn't realise that. It was full of cases, so we never really had the top down. That was pointless. Might as well have got a people carrier.
Joking. Well, did you catch any shark?
Absolutely loads, mate. Almost lost my finger in the process as well. Not through a glamorous bite or anything, as in like the bite of a shark. It was more I was freelining like a chunk of fish in the current and it was floating away. Basically, to start with, I had like 80 pounds braid on as and then a leader and everything. To start with, I was like feeding it off an open bail arm.
Yeah,
basically on one of the takes I was getting bite after bite. One of the takes, a loop of braid went round my finger, and imagine like it just latched on just as a shark took the bait. And it was pulling tight, literally pulling them against my finger, to the point that I thought it's going to basically just cut my finger straight off. Shark hook pulled.
the one you, lost.
It scored into the finger, but it was just, oh mate. And you know when you know it's about to happen as well, you're thinking there's nothing I can do here. It's not like I can unravel it. It's so tight at both points that, you know, it's just one of them. So absolute drama. But yeah, luckily my little finger lived to fight another day.
You had a decent hit at the Gillam's as well, didn't you? I remember seeing quite a few pictures when you were over there.
Yeah, great complex, mate. I mean, you know, it is what it is out there. It's an artificial venue, but it's really well run. Stuart really looks after the fish, and they're very careful of the water quality at all times. He's got bailiffs going round, putting manure in, treating the water, because ultimately them lakes, you know, the biomass isn't right. No matter what anyone says, you've got a lot of fish in a small volume of water, even though it's quite deep. You know, fish to over, well, I think 400 odd pound, which is mad if you think swimming around in a still water. Mate, you get liners on there, you just pull all three of your rods over and the pod. Oh, wow. It's not like a couple of little bleeps, you know, up and down, mate. The whole thing just wipe out, and you're like, oh.
Where did they get the fish from then?
I think there's a market in Bangkok, from what I've heard, and this place just sells absolutely everything. You know, tigers, arapaima, just everything, mate. I think you can get anything out there, and then they get bred on and grow. And the arapaima seem to do quite well in there. They breed, and I got captured by them. But the mistake I made is I took braid out there because Kev Knight mainline said, "Oh, take braid. You'll wind the Mekongs in quicker because they become a bit of a pest." You know, it's the first fish everyone catches, the Mekong catfish. But then after that, you end up wanting to catch the Siamese carp and the arapaima. But by having that braid straight through, like I did. And catching something, hooking like an arapaima, which has a mouth like a block of wood, any shake of the head coupled with no stretch in your line meant the hook was just, I mean, sometimes on a run, the hook would just drop out.
Yeah.
Anyway, it took me 20 odd bites to work this out, because I'd caught a couple in between, but you're supposed to land 60% anyway. I had 26 bites and I need 26 arapaima takes. I only landed six, but the last four I landed when I put a, you know, long stretch of mono on just to be like the shock absorber. And that just took the sting out of the braid. Yeah, which is obvious, sense. Really, when you look back at it. But I just thought, you know, because I was seeing people who've never fished just landing arapaima, you know, and just playing them on mono. But yeah, I was just that's stupid. That really must have had sunstroke, which I did actually get.
It's kind of like the old elastic rigs used to use years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Shock absorber. You think hard on hard along with no stretch. It's a recipe for disaster, isn't it? So same as tarpon in the ocean, really. That's a similar thing. You use circle hooks, but you never have a great purchase in their mouths. You're more like you've actually hooked them as opposed to penetrated into their, you know, into the flesh. You just literally like you got like a lock on as opposed to a hook in. So that's a different ball game. You better get a move on now. It's caught, I think, kickoff soon. Liverpool Bolton. I'm here. Look.
Yeah, we know you're an avid Liverpool fan, and we wouldn't
want to interrupt
the game. So I will say thank you very much for your time today. And when do we keep an eye out for the big fish off? When we like to see it?
Yeah, so the first show premieres Wednesday the 11th at 8 p.m. ITV4, and then we've got a fantastic repeat slot Saturday morning at 11:25 that Saturday, and then Sunday evening at 7 o'clock, all on ITV4. The weekend dates times will vary, but the Wednesday night 8 o'clock ITV4 slot won't. So that'll run for 5 episodes. We've got episode 2 is Kirk Norcross versus Julian Lewis-Jones. Episode 3 is Dacke versus Ollie Locke from Made in Chelsea. Episode 4 is the legendary David Seaman versus the Superbike former champ, the fastest man on pole, I believe, ever, Tommy Hill. And then the last show of the series is the lovely Scott Maslin versus my old school buddy, cricket record breaker, Graham Napier. So 5 great shows, great characters, loads of different fishing. And if you enjoy the series, make sure you come and see me at the Northern Show and we can chat about it there. Can't wait for that. You know, it's a show close to my heart. So anything I can do to help promote it and get more people there want to, because you all know I felt a little bit despondent last year. They didn't get there after all the fuss about a Northern Show. I didn't feel like the community got behind it as much. The timing maybe might have been a bit wrong.
Yeah, December was a mistake in hindsight. We've already sold this year more tickets than we sold for the entire show last year, and we've still got 6.5 weeks to go, so it's going to be a different, totally
ball
different
game. Yeah, I think the first show, you think back to the first one you did in March, it was a roaring success for the first year. I think it even took the trade by surprise, but it's such a passionate area for fishing up there. People love it. It deserves a great show. You know Corda as a company now, we're actually cutting back on the shows that we do, because I think there's too many in this country. There's way too many shows. I think they're done for the wrong reasons as well by a lot of people, but the Northern Show isn't. It's one done for the right reasons. That, you know, you and Roger especially have got a great history of putting on good little spectacles and social events up there, so the fact that you're involved with it, I knew would be a good thing. And you know, I hope this year it turns out to be even better than the very first show you did up there, and it just goes from strength to strength. So I hope that the angling community in the Northwest, the Midlands, Scotland, East England, absolutely everywhere north of the Watford Cap, go for it, because it'll be a good fun show.
Well, thank you for the endorsement, and thank you for coming on the Carpcast.
Cheers, mate. Take care, guys.
So a big thank you to Ali. Great interview, I thought. He's a top guy. Now, the show has aired, The Big Fish Off, and we have a section in our show called It's On The Net, It Must Be True.
It's on the net, it must be true.
There's been quite a bit of talk on the net about this show. I'm 70% positive I've read, having watched the show. I mean, what did you think of the show?
I've got to be honest, I've only seen the, about halfway through it so far. I've got the rest to watch of it when we've finished recording, but what I've seen, I actually quite enjoyed it. I mean, it's not a carp angling show. It's a general angling show aimed at general people. And to be honest, some of the people I've seen moaning and slating it on Facebook, I don't know what they were expecting. I enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it. I mean, I haven't watched a fishing program on TV for years. I don't watch a great deal of TV now. You know, listen to podcasts and watch sort of online stuff, Netflix, and, you know, stuff that I'm really into. So I don't generally watch what's on television. So I'd read all the stuff that other people had said on Facebook. I watched it. I thought it was great. I thought it was really entertaining. I was smiling, like a proper ear-to-ear smile. Tamer Hassan is just a great guy, and he was himself. And the pleasure he actually got when he played a fish himself, you know, not one of the small ones, but you could see the buzz he got twice. He really enjoyed it, and he was somebody that pretty much didn't want to be there. Looked like he was there because he was Mick Norcross's pal, and I don't think these guys are getting paid much, you know, not much compared to what he does in his normal gig.
He didn't seem full of enthusiasm just at the start, did he?
No, if you haven't seen the end yet, he catches a couple of decent carp, and
you've spoiled it for me now, but I'll watch it anyway.
Well, I'm presuming most people have seen it. I'm looking forward to it. I think it really crosses over to that kind of reality TV, you know, the fly on the wall, the Big Brother, all these kind of programs. I can imagine normal people watching this program and being entertained, because you know there was no technical stuff. It was the program was about the guests. I've seen a lot of stuff saying, "Oh, they're Z-list celebrities," but I mean, some people just don't live in the real world. You know.
Yeah, well, they're expecting Eminem.
Yeah. It's. I mean,
Ozzy Osbourne would be good.
Yeah, it'd be great, but unfortunately, you know, they don't have budgets of millions, you know, and yeah. Reality TV is generally Z-list kind of celebrities, and, you know, a few of them aren't Z-list, really. I mean, David Seaman, England footballer, top guy, Dappy's a pop star who's coming up, Dean Macy is an Olympian, and obviously known angler. They're not A-list, obviously, but they're decent guys. I was entertained. I really was, and I don't watch a lot of TV. And I then read some of the stuff that we've seen, you know, on the net, and I thought they watched a different program. I mean, these must be people with an extra grind already.
Definitely the impression I got off one or two things I read. But also, after almost 9 years of taxi driving, one thing I learned about the public in general is that there is people out there, they will moan about having nothing to moan about. They're like, they can't say anything unless they're saying something negative or trying to knock someone who's successful.
Yeah.
I don't listen to them, take no notice.
Yeah, and people like to moan on the internet, you know, it's the sort of trolling. And Corda have put themselves up in the public eye probably more than any other company, partly because of Ali's marketing background. But, I mean, they've become the easiest target to shoot at. And that's been the case for some years. And
yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, you know, I've been working in a tackle shop for about 6 months now. One thing that has surprised me is the amount of Corda stuff that sells. So I'm sure they don't mind being knocked here and there. They're making a lot of money through it.
No.
What they've done has worked.
Marketing works, you know, and then the fact that they are the first ones people slate means that it's kind of working what they do, because they are the one that's are at the forefront of, you know, of the marketing. If you know, name a company, most people are probably going to name them for, you know, Corda first. So I guess it's working. We're in an industry where people take it personally because it's a way of life. So, you know, people do moan about stuff, and you know, all the companies of the big brands have got some decent products and products that I wouldn't use. Probably every one of them.
Mm. Same
products that I wouldn't. Products that I probably wouldn't.
If you looked in my tackle box now, you'd see Nash, obviously, Corda, Tasker, ESP, all got its place.
Exactly. So just to slate it, because, you know, I think there was some slating going on because obviously Ali and Dean are Corda, but to be honest, there was virtually no mention of Corda. I watched it on the ITV replayer. There was a number of adverts and not one of them were for Corda. I'm sure they've got the logos at the end of it. But it's not advertising it. It's an entertainment program, and I think it worked. I think it really worked. But there were a few people on the net that were quite vocal. They did seem to be a minority. I think the feedback was mainly positive, and a few people surprised, like me, you know, surprised that they really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I've got Sky Plus, so I'll be watching the others.
Joe Jagger's got a slate in, didn't he? He's deleted it now, and I haven't actually read it, but just seeing what other people put. He made a post. Was it slating it?
It is, he's not deleted it. I've got it in front of me right now. Do you want it reading?
Yeah, go on.
Turned the big fish off on, took about 20 seconds, so he's obviously, you know, watched it through to get to a well-developed opinion. Took about 20 seconds to see what a load of tosh it was and turned it back off. Is that the best possible effort of putting a fishing show on mainstream TV, or is it somebody giving it the big one with a load of Z-listers?
And what went off after it?
Oh, there's about 89 comments I can see here at the minute. So I'm not going to go through any of them at the minute. They're not loading.
Joe's can be quite opinionated, same as us. But yeah,
he's a northerner.
I don't think it's an objective view, though, to watch it for a few seconds and turn it off. I'm pretty sure he didn't turn it off. It's an easy thing to say for Facebook slating. I get the impression he's jumping on a bandwagon. I believe Corda knocked him back when he lost his Nash consultancy.
Yeah, that was alluded to in the comments.
Yeah, and maybe it's a bit naive when somebody, you know, he writes in mags and stuff himself. You know, he's been very keen to put himself up, you know, in the public eye over the years. So to have an opinion like that, you're gonna get slated. I mean, a lot of the opinions I've seen, some people saying it's a bad image for fishing. I saw nothing bad in that program. You know, saying, oh, if they were doing it on the bank next to me, oh, doing what exactly? I didn't see anything that.
I saw him having a laugh.
Yeah, I've seen loads. I thought they, you know, even from a fishing point of view, they conducted themselves great. They were on a holiday resort, you know, Angler's Paradise they went to in Devon, which is aimed at all levels of fishing. It's an enjoyment, recreational type place.
Yeah, and the public perception of fishing is that it's boring. That you sit there watching a float vegetating all day. And a non-angler who's got that perception, they watch a programme like this, they see it's not like that. They see grown men acting like kids.
And the
enjoying themselves.
The passion that Tamer Hassan had after catching you know, a decent fish, he was converted. He said he'll go again, you know, and he's somebody.
Yeah.
He turned up late on the second day, you know, he didn't want to get out of bed when they're supposed to meet at 7:30. He tips up.
I do that now.
Yeah, and you know, they must have filmed it early spring as well, because it looked cold and the lakes were empty, so I'm guessing it was kind of pre-season.
Yeah, they did look wrapped up quite warm.
Yeah, so you know, and he obviously slept out. He's used to the Hilton, as I think he said, or other brands of hotel. And he was converted, you know. He was the focus of the programme. And I'm excited to see all the others, really. I know Dappy's a bit of a character. Enjoyed the bits that I watched when the missus had Big Brother on, when he was on that. He was a funny guy. I think there's a lot of future for the programme. It's because it kind of revolves around the celebrities. I can imagine them only getting better celebrities after the first one, and it being even more mainstream. You know, it, like I said, I can imagine normal people watching it, sort of people who watch reality shows.
Yeah, definitely. And there might even be a few celebs who fancy a crack at it.
What else has been on the net then this week?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Oh, there is something I did see which put a smile on my face. We both know Gordon Howsey runs St Ives Lakes.
Yeah.
Don't drop litter when you're down there. You'll get named and shamed on the Facebook site.
You should do anyway. I mean, dropping
definitely
lit, dropping lit is disgusting. You know, it annoys me. I'm driving behind somebody and they sling something out the car. It's, you know, without sounding like a tree hugger, because none of us are angels, but this planet, it's on borrowed time if we ruin it, you know. It's, and
your St. Ives ticket's on borrowed time if you drop litter as well.
quite right too.
Yeah, there's a couple of angles. They weren't even members, I don't think. I think they paid a day ticket fish the lagoon and left a pile of rubbish. So they were named and shamed and they'd not be welcome on St. Ives again. And I'll be honest, that puts a smile on my face, because litter, especially when it's carp angler litter and you know it is from what's there, it just bugs the hell out of me. And another one, tab ends and tea bags really pissed me off on the bank as well. Take them home.
Tab ends.
Tell
you're a Yorkshireman. If you don't know what he says, it is on Teletext page 215. it's disgusting. It makes me sick, especially in the winter when all the sort of trees go back and everything. You see all empty. It's plastic's the worst thing. You see all the empty bottles and, you know, tins and stuff. We've all fished park lakes covered in it, and it looks worse at this time of year. There's no leaves on the trees, and it annoys me. It winds me up. You know, no one else is going to clear it up. You know, if everybody did that for the next 10 generations, we'd all be swimming in it. You know, it's very short-sighted to see that, you know, people that just abuse nature. It's
especially when you know what it's like down the St. Ives complex. I mean, the lagoon itself is a lovely lake. You go over the road to the others, they are wild and unspoiled. It is a brilliant place, and leave it that way.
Yeah, I mean,
leave it as you find it.
There is a stereotype of day ticket anglers that it doesn't happen on syndicates, because everybody knows everybody. You're part of a kind of group, and, you know, people know who's been in what peg, and you just wouldn't get away with it even if you wanted to do it. Whereas, you know, some day ticket anglers have that kind of, you know, when I leave, I'm probably never going back mentality. And
it's someone else's problem, and they leave it to...
Yeah, I mean, it's a very bad thing about the human race in general, but it seems, you know, you don't get it on syndicates, or very rarely, because of the culpability, and that's the difference on a day ticket lake, is people think they can get away with it. So I'm glad they were named and shamed. Good on Gordon for doing it.
It also gives other fishery owners, they can see what, you know, especially now you say day ticket owners, what sort of people are around. I'd certainly be looking if I ran a lake.
I noticed on Facebook this week, they posted it everywhere, Fox and Spom have joined together. They've done a licensing deal, which I think is quite a smart move on both parts.
Definitely, I've seen that, and I've been an avid user. Did I introduce you to the Spom on Cromwell that time?
Yeah, I think you did.
Yeah, and I remember it was Andy who owns the Woolpack first showed me one, and I just looked at it and thought, what the hell is that? Shook my head, but once you see one in operation, you use one, there's no turning back. I don't think I've used a spod since.
It was one of the oldest problems in fishing, the spod. You know, you lose kind of a third of everything you cast out with it unless you plug it.
And then you've got to shake it to get it out.
And then if you use some really light stuff, you know, you have to tape it and fill it with water. And it was an implement that was there for the solving, and Spom solved it.
Yeah, and I think I've had some spods in the past that have put up more of a fight on the retrieve than some fish.
Exactly.
But the spod, it just comes straight back to you like a demented bat across the surface. It's brilliant.
Yeah, they hit the nail on the head, I think. You know, and I'm guessing most companies have had a go at making the perfect spod, and, you know, Spom were the first one to get there. And then we saw some copies. There was a few people posting one that looks kind of similar a few weeks ago, and I'm guessing that's what spurred this
deal. That yellow one?
Yeah. I forget what it was called, but, you know, there was a few threads on the net about the copy, and Mr. and Mrs. Spom, as they're affectionately known, were quite vocal about this copy. And Fox are known to... They're not shy of enforcing patents. They have done it numerous times with numerous different companies that I'm aware of. I know Nashie's had a few cease and desist letters about things they didn't even know that Fox had patented. And Mr. Fox likes patenting stuff. And he's not shy about instructing solicitors if he believes anyone's, you know, used something that he's patented, unbeknownstly or not. And I'm guessing they're coming up with it. Well, the statement read that they're coming up with a product between them, and, you know, the Foxy's might are going to be enforcing any infringements of the copyright, design and patent of the existing SPOM. So it's a very smart move from both parties, I think.
It can only be good, and let's see what Fox released with their... I'm sure I read, was it Impact Spod or something that's coming out?
Impact SPOM, I would have thought it was called. Yeah, is this, I think there's a... They say they're going to take it to the next level, because, I mean, Fox are an innovative company themselves, and be quite surprised if they just made a copy of it. You know, they're going to have to move the product on significantly somehow for them to not get slated themselves. But I'm guessing, I'm sure they've made fortunes out of the SPOM, but they only have one product, Mr. and Mrs. SPOM. So I'm...
in three sizes.
Of course. I'm guessing they maybe don't have the weight that a company the size of Fox have to actually protect themselves legally. And there'd be a few other companies kicking themselves now, I think, for not taking them on board.
I'm sure you're right.
It's on the net. It must be true.
Rob Hughes is set to captain the England team.
That can only be good.
I've not seen this. Rob's a friend, and he hosts the carp section of our fishing show, so we've got to know him better over the last 3 years. All-round great guy. Foreign superstar, as I said before.
Yeah, I believe I saw this mentioned on Twitter, confirmed by the Angling Trust, if I'm right. If I'm not right, I'm sure someone will correct me.
I think last year, wasn't there some controversy with... people from certain companies not being picked, and there seems to be a bit of politics in the picking of the England team last year.
Yeah, I did see a few mentions of that, but I've got to be honest, it went straight over my head. I'm not too I've only ever fished one carp match, which I helped organise. I fixed the draw and I still lost, so it's not really my forte, match carp fishing, and politics surrounding it I'm just not interested. I did see it mentioned, but didn't take any notice.
I think Corder sponsored it last year. I think this was a problem, and obviously Corder and Nash are public enemies. And I think who are the two? They're not with Nash anymore. Jamie and Billy. They're obviously, you know, two of the best match anglers in the country. And I believe once Corder took over, they kind of got moved into the reserves. I think there was a lot of hoo-ha at the time, you know, behind the scenes. I don't know who was responsible. Maybe we should know. Let's just say I think Rob Hughes will be a bit more independent. He's a Fox consultant, but I'm pretty sure the type of guy he is, you know, he's a lawyer. He's a very straight guy, and he will be doing the... I know he will take the England role seriously, and he'll want the best for the country rather than for an individual company he may be associated with. I'm sure of that.
We'll have to see when time comes around for these matches what happens, who gets picked, and we need to get a bit of pride back. I don't think we did too well in the big international carp matches last time.
Considering we're one of the main carp fishing nations...
we invented it.
Pretty much. I'm pretty sure the Chinese would have worked out to catch them before us.
No, they just breed them in funny colours. We catch them.
It'd be good to see what happens this year. I've had a little pop at the match fishing myself a few times over the years. You've noticed a few fish being caught this week as well?
Just a bit. I know last time out we mentioned a couple of big hits. Well, I'm looking at these now. I'm thinking I need to pull my finger out and start getting catching, because there is some seriously big fish coming out. Which 50 should we start with first?
What about the Frining one? Because I know about Frining. I made a DVD on there a few years ago. Biggest fish in there is called the Gurm. And, wow, it's big.
Yeah, 54 pound. Yeah, this is to a lad called Reese Miles, 19 years old, on his first trip to the place.
Wow.
That's not a bad way to break your duck on the water.
No, that's a cracking catcher for February. I mean, February's, even on the mild winters we've had, February is never a great month. We know there's certain lakes, your orchids, we talked about last time, that fish really well in the winter. Frining does fish okay in the winter, but, I mean, the biggest fish in the lake, a monster weight. I mean, that must be its PB weight. I know it made 50 last year, but...
It is monstrous. And you know what? He's not the only teenager catching 50s either.
Go on.
A 54-pound mirror for a lad called Charlie Terry, who was only 17.
Where was that from, do you know?
It doesn't actually stay, but say it. But if you see pictures of the fish, it does look like a certain Big Fish Park Lake. But it's not been named it, so we respect that and not name it ourselves. But still, 17 years old, a 54-pound mirror in February. What do you wear to keep your feet dry?
Ah, right, okay.
We've got there in the end.
Yeah, we got there. Yeah, I know. Yeah, that place does fish in the winter. I remember... well, it's a fair... I don't see why we can't name that lake.
Yeah. Well, it's out in the open, I know, but I've just out of respect for the lad. He's not named it in his report I've been reading, so...
Well, we can...
And I might be wrong anyway.
Well...
The appearance, it looks like...
A welly fish.
Yeah, one of them. You did that, not me.
Well, it's a private syndicate. You can't just turn up. There's a waiting list, and it's 1,500 quid a year. So I can't see it making any difference. It's not an open publicity water. Jim Shelley's had the big ones out there. Leon Bartrop had... he was the first one I remember to really catch all the big ones in the winter.
Yeah, he's one of those anglers. He always seems to do well in the winter.
He's a good angler. Leon. I think he fishes... He does fish all year round. I mean, the anglers that really go for it during the winter, they're the ones that have the captures. You know, John Mack on Raysbury quite a few years ago. I know he's fished a hell of a lot this winter, although he hasn't had much. He's been on the Oxford Lynch Hill complex. Well, I've not really seen any fish, but I know he's been there a lot. And Leon always fishes in the winter. I remember him doing the entire winter on the Manor a few years back now. It's when I did a guest session on there with him and Dave Levy.
The Essex Manor.
The Essex Manor. Where all the geezers fish.
Yeah, they talk funny down there.
And there's one from Cornwall as well, isn't there? 4612?
Yeah, a common.
Wow.
I've got it here in front of me now. Where is it? 46 pound 12 ounce, a fish known as Biggles.
Biggles. Mm.
Yeah, I'm assuming it's got some Popeyes then or something. It's caught from Boscathno Reservoir.
Boscathno. I used to fish Cornwall Reses when I was a kid. There's quite a few decent ones down there. College Reservoir, I used to go to. Lower Tamar was another one. There's some great fishing down there, but I don't know that one.
Yeah, it's caught by, it says just outside Penzance. Caught by a lad called Ed Teakle. He's not a teenager, though. He's 31.
Yeah, well, those are the ones I just named were more Devon. Penzance is right down the bottom of Cornwall, isn't it? That's quite a bit further south.
Yeah, it's a nice-looking fish as well. You know, it looks like an old warrior common sort of thing.
And there's been around, 40 out of pit three as well. Frimley, that used to do fish in the winter years ago. That's where Mailin... had all his fish on maggots many, many years ago.
It's not a common either. It's one of the fully scaled mirrors is topped 40 in there.
Oh, wow. He was going pike fishing, wasn't he? Alistair Stevens, wasn't it?
Yeah, we've got the first fully scaled mirror from the famous Frimley complex to go over 40. It's 40 pound 14 ounce to Alistair Stevens from Pit 3. And if you've ever seen pictures of those fish, they are... proper stunning, big plated, fully scaled.
I've not fished this February. I mean, I'm gagging to get out, but there's decent fish getting caught already.
Are we going to go for 50 number three next?
Oh, there's another one. Okay.
There is. And the biggest. Ashmead, single scale, £57 to a fella on a guest session.
That is ridiculous. Two 54s and a 57 in February, plus a number of 40s from other lakes.
Yeah, I'm sure there's quite a few more that we've not mentioned as well. And they're not just scraper 50s either, two 54s and 57. It makes you wonder when some of these fish are going to push through, break 60 and even threaten the record.
Well, there's one known 60 at the minute that I know. I'm sure there's a few quiet ones. Well, there's one quiet one I can think of from near to a place that used to have a caravan on it that we looked at once upon a time. Big lake near there has got a good 60 in it that's only a select few can fish for.
You know what? I'd chop an arm off if I could fish that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there's quite a few big ones in there from what I can gather. We will not name that one because people might try and camp out on there. It's not easy to fish. If it was easy to poach, I'd have been poaching it.
That's not like you. You've never poached.
Guesting, we call it these days. Sounds nicer. Yeah, but the actual known about ones is that the Reading one.
The Loftus. Parrot, they call it.
Yeah, Bernie Loftus had it not long back, didn't he? A big weight.
That was 64. It's a stunning looking fish as well.
It's a cracker, yeah. But I mean, there aren't many sixes these days since the death of the Conningbrook fish. And, you know, I thought it's going to be a long, long time till anything gets even close. What was it? The Conningbrook fish's best ever weight? 67, was it?
67 an ounce. I don't know the exact, but when you think of the amount of fish, if you just say that are within 10 pound of it, not over 60, so like anything, say 57, 58 plus, there is a few. I mean, the one that really does impress me is the one up in Yorkshire, in Eric's Willows, it did 58, because it ain't an old fish.
No, and it's a decent shape. It's black as the Ace of Spades. I mean, I would like to catch that fish. I've fished a couple of sessions on there for a Nash Road show and did a day ticket on there last March, I think. And we had a few of the smaller fish, nothing bigger than 25, 26. But I like that lake. I do intend on doing a few day ticket sessions on there this year. Them fish were put in very small. I know there's the Keep It Real Brigade believe that they're not proper, but they went in smaller than the Conningbrook fish, so I can't see how you could ever call them not proper.
Yeah, they all went in legal, and if it ever does break the record, I'm sure a few of them would run round in circles and disappear up their own backsides. I certainly wouldn't mind catching it, put it that way.
No, I mean, that big one out of there, it doesn't come out a lot. It's certainly not an easy fish to catch, is it? Is it once a year?
I don't think it's a regular. I think when it actually came out at 58 was quite a shock. I mean, it was a known big fish, but just not that big.
Cap. Top trumps. So, we're going to move on to a section that we call Big Carp Top Trumps, where we compare two fish against each other in five different categories, and we come up with a winner. So this week's two fish are a fish known as the motorway biggin from the motorway pond in Yorkshire. Mark's going to take that one. Versus another deceased fish, same as the motorway biggin, known as the halfling, which was from a private lake in Manchester that I was lucky enough to catch. First category is weight. What was the motorway biggin's biggest weight?
I'm not sure exactly, but I know it went, I think it went over 43 once. And it was definitely done 42s because I know a couple of people who've caught it there.
So these are north v north fish, really. So
it is each side of the Pennines. And after you beat me last week, I'm not taking defeat again.
Well, it's the War of the Roses. It's a true War of the Roses. We're going to mark these relatively, not compared to 50s and 60s in the country. We're going to mark them on the basis of they are northern fish. So 43 pound, would you give that marks out of 10?
I'd give it 10. It was the biggest fish in Yorkshire for quite a while. I believe it was the second or third you've thought a Yorkshire had ever done.
I'm not sure you can give it a 10 just because we've just been discussing a 57 from Yorkshire. So that surely has to be the 10, which means a motorway biggin has to be a 9 or an 8, surely.
Well, I don't think the Eric's fish, it was stocked, or it might not have even been born when this one was around doing 40s.
Yeah, but if we're going relative, you know, if we're going size, if we ever do that one, then...
I may be biased. All right, 9.
I'll let you have a 9. It's a very... There weren't many bigger fish in Yorkshire before or since, apart from the 1740s in Eric's Willows.
Yeah, even though now if you take Willows out of the equation, there's not a massive amount of big fish.
No, true. You're too tight to feed them. That's what it is.
Yeah, that is some of the best single hook bait anglers come from Yorkshire. Yeah. Can't be denied. I'm one of them.
I'd still want to be giving it an 8.
Yeah, what would you give the Halfling then? What was the top weight there? I know it did 40.
It just did 40, yeah, it scraped over. I think it might have been 41. Was it Tudge, Mark Tunnicliffe, that was the first one? I think it might have done two captures over 40. I lost it almost definitely over 40. It would have been the first. I know it was just after Tudge had it, actually, I think. I'd lost it the net in the winter. I went on that lake to target, and I wanted to catch a Northwest 40. I had a mega session in November. I pulled off the Manchester Park Lake because I was trying to fish for Mr. Angry in there, and it shut up shop. Went on to the other lake and had a mega session. I had a 30, quite a few of the originals, all the upper 20 originals. It was in really sort of gale force winds, trees came down, all sorts. Just one of their mega sessions, and the fish were having it. And I had a fish. Stayed deep in the margins, right in front, like really, really heavy, plodding around. This is about, yeah, it's about, I'm sure it was about a month after it had already been 40, that Tudge's capture. Anyway, I lost it, the net, the hook flew out.
Ouch.
And then I caught it, I actually caught it again, did exactly the same thing on the fight in February of, you know, like 2 months later. I had another session where I caught a few fish, and it was 100% that fish that I lost. It did exactly the same thing. The battle stays deep in the edge, and according, it was 39-12 after a kind of a cold winter. So this was like when I lost it, it was end of November. When I caught it, it was sort of mid-February, 39-12. Yeah, I'm sure I lost it at 40. But it was Manchester's second ever 40. So it needs an 8, I think. I would say the motorway just pips it.
I can go with that.
Looks.
Now, these are two very, very different looking carp. Yeah. I think we might even have a tie on this one, because the motorway biggin was a big, deep, big-shouldered, stocky fish. Whereas a Halfling, if I remember, was quite, quite long and lean.
Long and lean, yeah. With it's called the half limb because it's got the linear scales, don't go all the way up it. They start from the back and go sort of halfway, a few nice big plates. I mean, it's definitely a cracking looker, the half limb. You know, you couldn't say it was a horrible fish. It had a perfect mouth, had the perfect kind of long shape. It wasn't fat. And, you know, it's got some big plates on its side. So I'm being biased because it's mine, but I'm saying it has to be up there. It's certainly not just a big, fat fish.
Yeah, I mean, with the motorway biggin, I remember a friend of mine called John Davis. He caught it was a 42-pound capture. It's first time over 40. It had been on the missing list for I think it was almost 2 years, and he had it on. I only had a day permit, and he did appear on the cover of Carp Talk, and it just looks clean and solid. You know, real well conditioned, lovely mouth on it.
I'd plumb for an 8 on the Halfling. Are you going for something similar, would you think?
I was thinking 8 as well for the motorway biggin. It wasn't a big, a shiny, scaly thing, but it was like, remember old shoulders from Horton? It was like its northern cousin.
Okay, I'll give you an 8. What about the fight? I mean, you didn't catch it, but you spoke to people that did.
I don't think it was a mental fight, from what I've been told, but more of just a heavy plod. I could be wrong, obviously, but not having caught it myself, but I don't think it was known as a fish that's going to beat you up.
The Halfling did give a good account of itself. I caught it again, braced it with the other big one in there.
Was that Hamlet?
Hamlet, yeah, in the summer of that year, June it was, I think. And obviously it got away because it fought hard the first time I hooked it. The second time, it gave a mega account of itself. And the third time did exactly the same thing. The third time, I'd had a fish in the morning at first light, and bite time in that peg was up to about 11 a.m. And I had a bite quite early for that peg. So I thought, I'll get all the rods sorted, get them out perfectly. Anyway, I ended up messing it up. You were casting long, about 95 yards into a corner, and you had two or three rods in that corner. it was tricky, especially if there was any sort of wind blowing in there. The line would catch the trees sort of far out because it was a big old whack. And I ended up going over the rods and ended up having about 50 casts trying to get two rods out there. And just thought, I've completely ruined the chance of a bite. And there's no chance of catching a fish now. You know, I've messed it up. Should have left the one rod that was out there and just not bothered trying to get another one back out. I gave up in the end. It took about 2 hours, crack-offs in the tree, all sorts. And when I finally got it out, there was one that just went bang, right in the zone, like right in the corner. I put the rod tip under the water to try and get the line down, and it tightened up. It pulled the rod up. And anyway, I was like, that's weird. And like lifted the rod up, and it just charged on a 30-yard run. This is at 95. It must have been sat there right under the snags in the corner. As soon as it banged in front of its mouth, it went yam and had the bait. And even at that distance, sort of 95 yards, I couldn't stop it. It just flat-rodded me. And then it used to come in sort of kind of across the lake reasonably okay. And then when it got in the edge, you had a good 15 minutes under the rod tip of it staying deep and hard. You know, no way was it guaranteed you were landing that fish when you hooked it. So for that, I would give it a 9 for sure.
Yeah, I can't argue with that, and I think I'm going to have to concede on this one with the motorway big and probably plump for a 7.
I think 7's fair for that. Okay, yeah. On to the next category, which is difficulty.
Yeah, motorway big and was not an easy fish to catch.
How many times a year did it come out?
Anything from 0 to, I don't think, 3, 4, 5 tops. I know it was known for doing quite lengthy periods. Like before it went 40, it was, I think it was knocking on for 2 years between captures. A lot of people were saying it wasn't even there anymore, but it was, it came out.
Okay, that's got to be up there on the scores then. What, like an 8 or something?
I'd plump for an 8.
Okay. The halfling, It would come out 3 times a year, I think. It usually came out in the spring. It would come out in the autumn. And if somebody put the effort in over the winter, obviously like I did that year, I caught quite a few fish and I did hook it a couple of times. It would quite often do a summer capture. But it would usually do 3 to 4 captures a year. So it wasn't an absolute ball breaker. But, you know, you had to be fishing correctly to catch it. You know, there's lots of people who wanted to catch it that didn't. So I'd probably go for a 7.
Yeah, I can't argue with that, although it does seem, where you say you've got to fish it correctly, it's more of the nature of the lake is difficult rather than the actual fish. If you get it right, you're in with a good chance.
Yeah, that'd be right. There's a lot of long-distance fishing on there, so, yeah, you have to be capable of fishing at sort of 90 yards to 100. Yeah. Obviously presenting baits correctly at that distance is all part of the game.
Yeah, a lot of people are, they might like to say they're casting 140 yards, but they're really casting 80.
They can't get away with it now that everybody wraps their rods out and counts the wraps. It's pretty difficult to lie about distance now.
Yeah, do you do that?
Yeah, definitely. It's probably the biggest practical innovation in fishing I've adapted in years.
I've never actually done. Well, I've done it once, which was actually on a tuition I was doing, so I needed to know exactly. But when I've needed to be that accurate, all I've done is just paste the line out along the bank, just kicked a divot in the ground, and hope no bailiff sees me and tells me off for being away from my rods.
Well, it's. The beauty of it is you don't need to rely on, you know, such a long path down the back. It's way more accurate because your strides are not always exactly the same. And
I've not counted my paces. I've actually measured it on the bank. I've dropped my leads, say, next to the bivvy door or next to something, and I've gone and dropped a brick in the side of the path or kicked a divot out the floor or snapped a branch.
It's just way more accurate, and it's done away with the marker float for me. So I'll have a lead around with my normal rod.
Yeah.
I'll have a lead around until I actually find something I'm happy fishing on. Then I'll wrap it. I will mark the line on the line, and, you know, obviously write down the number of reps, and then I'll just rep my spom to the exactly the same amount of reps, and then, you know, cast the rig out, do the spom on top. It's great if, you know, if you get cut off or snapped or anything, you know exactly how many reps it is. It's just a great way of fishing. I know it could easily go in the in our carp are not sheep section, but I actually think it's a great...
Yeah, it is a practical innovation. Even, you probably didn't notice, but there was Preston Innovations had a YouTube video recently with Tom Pickering feeder fishing doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I saw it. It's even more so when you're feeder fishing, you want it exactly where the bait is.
Yeah, because they're casting infinitely more times than what we are.
Yeah, definitely. They're casting all day long, every 10, 15 minutes maybe. So, yeah, it's good. Let's get back to this.
We are going off on a bit of a tangent. Difficulty.
The merit. We've done difficulty.
We did. Merit.
Merit of capture. It was a big deal to catch the motorway big one, I'm aware.
Oh, without a doubt.
It was certainly up there. If you call the motorway big one, it's got to be a 9 or a 10, I would have thought, from... it wasn't
definitely
difficult to... It wasn't easy to get a night ticket on there in the first place to have a reasonable chance of fishing.
That's true. It was like dead man's shoes, a waiting list. I think it was something ridiculous, 15 plus years. But as I had a couple of sessions on it, anybody could buy a day book and fish it from 5 a.m. till I think it was 9 or 10 at night, any time of year. And it was caught on a day book several times.
Yeah. Well, like I say, I mean, it was up there with it. For a Yorkshire fish, it was, it probably was the one.
Yeah, for the time it was there and it was up, it was the one. And I think I'm going to try for a 10 here. It was the fish in Yorkshire to catch.
Yeah, I can't argue with the 10. As far as the halfling goes, there was two fish in the Manchester area you wanted to catch,
Angry and the Halfling.
Angry and the Halfling, yeah. Angry, I would say, probably pips it. That will be a 10 if we do that fish.
Yeah, that's not an easy one to catch, I know that.
No. But I'd probably go 9 for the Halfling. So?
Yeah, there is that, but I've got to say, Joe Jagger caught that fish. Does that make him meritorious or not? Only joking, Joe. We love you, really. But
we love you. Yeah, I mean, he was the only one fishing at the time. That's one good thing about that lake is it doesn't get that busy, and quite often late in the year, there's a big hill to get up going back as well, which puts a lot of people off fishing it. Cardiac Hill, they call it. As I found, when I fished it right through the winter, I had to place myself most weeks, and I caught most of the fish, the name fish. If you're the only one on there, Miles caught it doing the same thing. He was pretty much the only one, kept his bait going in a certain area, and it didn't take him long to do it. If it was a busy lake, if there was quite a few, bit of competition on there, it wouldn't be so. You wouldn't have it all your own way. So, yeah, but yeah. I still think, that's probably more in the difficulty section, the actual merit of the capture. You catch the Halfling, it's a very significant achievement for the Northwest. The merit of it is definitely a 9.
Yeah, I can't argue with that.
Right, let's add these up. So we'll do the Halfling first. 8 and 8 is 16, plus 9 is 25, plus 9 again is 34, plus 7 is 41. And the motorway big one, we've got 9 at 8, 17, plus 7, 24, 10, 34. And the 8 makes 42. By 1 point, this week's Carp Top Trumps winner is the Motorway Pond Biggin.
Hey, that's one all. I'll be taking the lead next week.
Carp Top Trumps.
So we move on to another of our regular sections called Carp Are Not Sheep. Or, as if you're from Yorkshire, Carp Ain't Sheep. Where basically we look at trends in carp fishing that people just seem to jump onto without really knowing why they're doing it.
Carp are not sheep.
This week's topic is slack lines, something that's been synonymous with carp anglers, and some people are just obsessed by it. in recent years.
Yeah, and no matter how many times or how many videos appear proving how useless it is, people still do it. Tell me, when was the last time you've seen a feeder fisherman watching his tip with a line hanging limply from the end? You don't. And you know what? When I'm fishing, this is all times of year, not just winter, but especially in winter, I'll have my rod set up on single sticks pointing directly down the line. Yeah. I get a single bleep, I'm up, and I'm looking where that line enters the water. Any unnatural movement, I'll pick the rod up and strike. And I've caught countless fish doing that. You ain't going to do that with slack line. A fish is going to be sat there and he's going to get away with it. Unless that fish bolts off, in which case it's got to go about 10 foot before it even gives you a single bleep because your line's that slack. It's just folly.
I think I can tell you're very passionate about this. I think, so I can tell you're very passionate about this. I remember Carpology and Rob Hughes in these underwater diving stuff that he does for Carpology. I remember them testing this exact theory, and I've spoke to him at length about it as well. If there's anything between you and your spot, between you and the lead, any weed, anything, then slack lines is an absolute waste of time, because it's going to be tight between the lead and that weed. Let's say there's some weed halfway between you and your rod. No matter how much you slacken it off, the line between the lead and the weed is going to be tight, assuming you've, you know, landed the lead on the tight line. And even then, you'd have to let the lead drop in naturally with the bail arm open and let everything settle in the spot. I suppose you could make it better. I just don't see the point. Your indication's going to be virtually zero.
If you're fishing for fish that are even slightly pressured, you just, unless they bolt, like I've said, it's a waste of time. And another thing, when, you know, back how it was in pit two, it wasn't exactly bailiffed, was it? Well, I had a few feature finding missions with a snorkel and mask. And believe me, some of the crap I seen on the bottom of that lake, I want my line nowhere near it. It's, you're just asking for cutoffs and your line to be damaged.
Yeah, it's, and you know, the whole point of slacklining is maybe to give yourself an edge over very wary fish. Very wary fish don't bolt. When I was fishing syndicate lakes and stuff, I can't remember getting a screaming take in 3 or 4 years, you know, of numerous captures. Yeah. You know,
Wolfpack was like that.
Yeah, I remember thinking, I haven't had a screamer, you know, one that's actually spun the reel, in years. So if these fish are that cute, then you're not going to get much indication anyway. You know, they're going to tighten off and go into the nearest weed bed. Then why would you want to not know when that's happened? It's crazy.
Yeah, I want to know everything I can what's going off at the business end, which is how I set my rods up like I do.
The only place I could ever see it being useful is if, you know, you're fishing a deepish lake and there's no weed in it at all. You know, you can sink the lead down on a tight line and then slacken it off with fluorocarbon or whatever and just let it all settle to the bottom naturally. Because I think if you've got no obstructions, then the slack line theory kind of does come in. So it can be more, it can be, you can get more indication because it, if you picture a float with very light line, so let's say you're float fishing and you've got the line that's in an arc on the surface. If you try and straighten that line up, the line doesn't straighten, the float will move to the left. Let's say it's all blowing in a curve to the left. If you try and reel it in quickly, the float will go to the left rather than the line straighten out. And that's because the float is lighter than the resistance of the water on the line. So if you imagine your float is a light bobbin, when something moves the lead, rather than try and tighten up the slack line, it's just going to move it just like the float does on the surface. So I get the point of it if the conditions are right, but I mean, what lakes are not weedy these days?
I was just going to say that. When was the last time you fished a lake as you just described?
Yeah, it's very commercial day ticket lakes where they treat the weed really. I mean, that's it.
Yeah. And then you've got to think about bottom contours as well.
Yeah,
if there's any sort of trough between you and your hook bait where it goes back up,
you've got the resistance.
Here again,
you've got the resistance of the water, though. Like I said, with the float fishing analogy, it's going to move a light bobbin. So I mean, that's how I fish. I fish a light bobbin I fish the lightest bobbin I can get away with you know, wind and stuff. And I let the weight of the bobbin keep the line taut. So I don't go super slack, but I don't tighten it up like a bowstring either, because I think that also does away with indication when, because your line's like an elastic band. A standard line's got a 12% stretch. If you're fishing at 100 yards, say, that's 12 yards of stretch in the line. So if you imagine an elastic band, if you elastic band your line and you hold your finger in one end of the elastic band and pull it to its natural sort of tension, not stretch it, but just pull it to its natural tension with your other finger, that's how I try and fish my line. If you try and stretch the elastic band out, say, half, when you get a bite, it's just going to stretch it more as opposed to use its own pressure. And that's how I try and fish when I fish with nylon.
Yeah, what you're saying, which is why I spent 50 quid getting a 3,000 metre spool of line imported from America earlier last year.
Yeah, I mean, it's a carp angler's nightmare, the stretch that is in line. I quite like the fluorocarbon lines these days.
Well, you know, like that. I do use it as well, the Evolution stuff.
Yeah, the Fox Evolution, yeah.
P-Line Extrusion, they call it in Europe.
Yes, sorry. I've just put the Fox one on recently when I needed some line to go to France. But yeah, that P-Line Extrusion, it deteriorates quicker than some lines, but it's got 6% stretch, which is pretty low. It casts like a dream. And I've struggled to get hold of it recently, though. The place I was getting it from,
the Europe website, you come to check out and it says website is closed for maintenance or something.
Yeah, I've tried ordering it a couple of times. I think what's happened is they've sold the licensing to people in different countries, so they're not allowed to sell it from their website direct now. I think it's somebody in Newcastle Way. I did speak to a guy that had paid some money. They're a sea fishing brand or shop.
Yeah, I forgot the name of the shop. I spoke to him as well, and you could get some of the other P-Lines from him, but he didn't have any of the extrusion in, so... Well, I did. I went. I looked on the on eBay. It was found someone in. I can't remember where it was. I think it was South Carolina or somewhere that was selling these 3,000 meter spools. I just messaged him asking how much postage would be to England, and he came back with the price. I think I paid about 50 something quid, and then a couple of weeks later it turned up. So that's me sorted for the next couple of seasons.
I'm pretty sure you're not going to be fishing it slack.
No. It's got quite, it's not one of these sinker lines either. Its buoyancy is pretty neutral, which I don't mind anyway.
Carp and not sheep.
Okay, so we've yabbered on quite a bit. This podcast is loads of features we didn't get through, so more next time. But we like to finish each podcast with a look at the forthcoming weather over the next 7 to 10 days. And we pick a town in the north, a town in the Midlands, and a town in the south, and get the most up-to-date weather forecast. So, do you want to have a look at the northern one, Mark? Leeds?
I certainly do, because I'm actually off fishing myself on Sunday. Leeds is close enough to Doncaster. I'm on the xcweather.co.uk. So let's see what's happening. There we go. I've got Saturday. Temperatures are looking slightly on the up. We've got a low of 5. It's up to 8. Easterly winds, though, up to only about 10, 12 mile an hour, with a sunshine and cloud. Though the important one that carpers love is the pressure. We're down to about 1,005.
Well, that's looking pretty good.
Yeah, it does. Pressure is raising a bit over the weekend. It's up to like 1,014 come Sunday. Again, weather and wind staying pretty much the same. And that's the weekend for Leeds.
I'm having a look at the Yorkshire. I'm having a look at Aldershot here. I use WeatherPro, the iPhone app, which I always found pretty good. Weekend, it's the same 7s to 9s sort of maximum temperature in the day, which is definitely better than the 5s and 6s we've had this week. Sort of 2s the coldest. Pressure's about the same, 1,003, rising slightly during the weekend. Next week, we've got a day of 10 degrees. Wednesday is showing, which will be the first double figures we've had for quite some time. Although what happens when you get a bit of sun and some 10 degrees in the daytime, you get a
frost.
Frosty night usually, yeah. So it's showing 0 for the night. and the pressure's rocketing. By Wednesday, it's up to 10.37 in the Aldershot area. Do you want to have a look at Coventry for the Midlands?
Yeah, I've got it on now. And over the weekend, to be honest, it's looking pretty pretty similar to Leeds. You know, we've got the easterly winds in the low teens with a sunshine and cloud. That's the same on Sunday, but again with the pressure, it's starting off down below 1,000 on the Saturday, but by the end of the Sunday, it's up to 1,014. If I look later on in the week, where we've got Wednesday, we're on 1,038.
Yeah, it's the same everywhere. I think there's a big pressure rise. So, I mean, that's good for this time of year. It means we're starting to get a bit of sun on the water, which is going to warm it up quicker.
But, and we're getting more daylight as well.
Yeah, and it's going to mean some frosty nights. And I'd also like to look on my FishCal app, which is basically moon phases and tells you sort of how good the fishing's going to be. Next week is my favourite phase of the month, every month, which is the new moon period. And the actual new moon day is the 18th, Wednesday the 18th. It's coinciding with that high pressure, actually. You only get a couple of new moons during the year that are high pressure, and this is one of them, which is probably not one of the best ones. So, 18th and 19th is like 100% fishing efficiency every day. So it's going to be cold at night, warm in the day. Maybe that'll spur the fish into action with the moon.
It could do. Although, since you mentioned moon phases, I'm going to blame the moon for me blanking last week.
Yeah, it wasn't a great period next week. We will cover the moon on future shows.
It is useful as an excuse.
But for now, I think that's enough for this week, and we'll catch you next time.
Yep, see you next time.
The Carpcast is brought to you by the Northern Angling Show, held at Event City in Manchester for the third time on the 28th and 29th of March 2015. You can purchase tickets at www.northernanglingshow.co.uk.